an organization called the American Civil Liberties Union, and so I apologize to those of you in the audience. Most of what I do focuses on the United States, but I think you'll see there is a solid nexus to what happens here in Canada, particularly given that you are all relying on companies in my country to host your data. This is Louis Brandeis, who is the father of modern privacy law in the United States. He was a Supreme Court justice. He wrote an extremely powerful dissent in one of the most important privacy cases of our time. It was the first wiretapping case in the United States. So the wiretaps were used beginning in about 1895 in New York, and it wasn't until 1928 when the Supreme Court got to take a crack at the issue. The majority of the court actually got it the wrong way, but Brandeis's dissent has lasted the test of time, and I just want to read you a couple things from that dissent because it really sort of lays the groundwork for what I want to discuss. He said, "The progress of science in furnishing the government with means of espionage is not likely to stop with wiretapping. Ways may someday be developed by which the government, without removing papers from secret drawers, can reproduce them in court, and by which it will be enabled to expose to a jury the most intimate occurrences of the home." So this was in 1928, before Google, before Facebook, before Twitter, before we used cloud computing, before we stored our documents in the cloud, before, in the days when the police really did have to come to your house to figure out what you were doing. But he saw that at some point down the road, the government would have a way of knowing what was taking place in our homes without actually ever visiting our homes. And of course, his dissent didn't talk about Google. It didn't talk about these future technologies, but he knew that it was going to happen and it would take place in some form, and he was exactly spot on. Today, the police don't have to enter our home to find out what we're thinking. They don't have to break down our door to look through our papers. And they don't have to provide any display of their surveillance to actually learn our most private information. So this is what a wiretap looks like in the movies. This is a slide from an older sort of graphic novel or comic book. But in the 1950s, this is what the movies made wiretapping look like. And in fact, even the movies and cop shows today look like this, although, of course, the equipment is a little bit fancier. But the general idea that's conveyed in the movies and in TV shows in popular culture are that there'll be a secret FBI van, an unmarked FBI van parked outside your home. You know, maybe it'll say Joe's Pizza House outside. And you see this image of an FBI agent sort of hunched over with a pair of headphones on his or her head, listening to the calls that are taking place just next door. And while that makes for great TV, while it makes for a compelling image on the big screen, that isn't what modern surveillance looks like. The police don't need to put themselves at risk. They don't need to follow you. They don't need to show up outside your house. Today, modern surveillance looks a lot more like this. There are keys typing at a keyboard. The police officers or whoever is performing the surveillance will be in an air-conditioned office, sitting in a comfortable chair, and will not have to put themselves either at physical risk of harm or even the risk of discovery. Their surveillance is entirely covert. But as we think about how this modern surveillance takes place, as we think about surveillance through a keyboard, I think it's important to think about whose fingers are actually at the keyboard. Because for the most part, the police and federal law enforcement agencies and intelligence agencies don't have to actually perform the surveillance anymore themselves. They don't go into the wires in your building and attach a cable to listen to your calls. Today, the people who are actually performing the surveillance are employees of the companies to whom we entrust our most private data. Google, Facebook, Microsoft, the telephone companies, all of these companies employ teams of people who do nothing but respond to surveillance requests. That's all they do. From the moment that they show up at work after they've had their first coffee of the morning, all they do are look through the orders they've received, process them, dig up the communications of their customers, initiate wiretaps, and then send that information back to the authorities. In some cases, the companies will combine the teams that respond to divorce lawyers and police, and in other cases, there will be different teams that do both things. But these companies all have people who focus on these tasks, and these teams are large. Sprint, which is the third largest telephone company in the United States, has more than 150 people who do nothing but respond to surveillance requests. And these companies have been inundated with requests from governments, because it turns out that reading someone's email or tracking someone's cell phone makes life easier for the police. It's a really useful source of data. And so as law enforcement agencies in the United States and around the world have discovered this source of surveillance information, they have started to flood these companies with requests. And that changes how the surveillance works, and it changes the impact on our society. So in general, two things protect us from living in a surveillance state, from living in an oppressive world that I think many of us would not want to live in. The first is the law. Congress in the United States, your parliament here, sets rules that govern when law enforcement agencies and the intelligence community can look through our private papers, when they can watch what we're doing, when they can learn who we're talking to. And unfortunately, the law typically lags behind technology. So in the United States, the law that governs when the government can obtain your communications, and of course, even though you live in Canada, you are subject to U.S. law when your communications are sitting on a server in the United States or are controlled by a company in Mountain View, California. The Electronic Communications Privacy Act in the United States was written in 1986 and hasn't really been updated in any substantive way. And so if you used a telephone in 1986, it probably looked something like this. It was huge. It had a very poor battery life, although that hasn't really changed. And if you used email in 1986, you were probably using a service like CompuServe or AOL or something along those lines. And the law that we have in the United States reflects the technology that existed in 1986. And it reflects the way people used technology in 1986. For example, the statutory law that we have in the United States reflects the way that email was used in 1986. So back then, if you had an inbox, if you were lucky enough to have email, you probably had, you know, a 2 or 5 megabyte inbox. And so what happened was someone would send you an email message and you would read it and you would respond and then you would delete it. You wouldn't keep it for long periods of time because you needed to make space for other emails to come in. And if someone were so rude as to send you an attachment, then you would scream at them because they would potentially fill up your quota. And so the statutory rules that we have in the United States right now reflect the way that these email systems were used. And so no one would ever leave their emails on a server for more than 6 months in 1986. That would be considered to abandon the emails. And so our statutory laws and the laws that apply to you when you use Google and Facebook and other companies offer less protection to emails after they have been stored more than 180 days. Now, there have been court cases that have examined this, and protections have been boosted through interpretation of our Constitution, but the statutory laws lag behind the usage of technology. Things like location, the word location doesn't appear in the Electronic Communications Privacy Act. The word social doesn't appear there because social media didn't exist in 1986. And so really what I'm saying is that Congress, my Congress, hasn't done a very good job in protecting our rights through updates to the law. So as I said, two things protect us from a surveillance state. The first is the law, and that obviously hasn't really kept up. And the second is the expense or difficulty of surveillance. So as a general rule of thumb, when surveillance is expensive, the government doesn't do very much of it, and when it's cheap, the government can do more. And when surveillance was really expensive, the government did indeed do less of it. So in years past, where the police needed to have a team of people to track you, so if they wanted to track your movements, they would put, you know, 5 or 10 people on you, they would tail you. They would have, you know, a couple of vehicles that would follow you. And if you saw the same vehicle in your rearview mirror for hours on end, you would know something was up. So they'd need to switch vehicles. Those agents would need, you know, breaks. They'd need to go to the bathroom. They'd need to sleep. And so it was very intensive, manpower intensive, to perform 24-hour surveillance of location. That is not the case today. As people have moved from physical tracking to electronic tracking, the cost of surveillance has gone down. And so whatever friction was there because of the cost has been eliminated. This is an excerpt from a surveillance manual. So all of the big internet and telephone companies in the United States have menus. In the same way that you go into a restaurant and there's a different price for the steak and a different price for the fish, well, all of the internet and phone companies have menus that dictate the prices they charge for surveillance. So you might imagine that there's a different price for a copy of your inbox as there might be for a wiretap of your phone line. Some things cost more money, and so the telephone and internet companies are permitted by law to pass along the cost of performing that surveillance to the authorities. And so this is a copy of the surveillance manual for a company called Nextel, which merged with Sprint, our third largest telephone company. This is their manual from 2003. And I've just excerpted one particular part, which is that in 2003, they had the ability to locate cell phones upon a request by the authorities. And what would happen is the police would send over a fax with the right kind of court order, and then an employee of this company would type a few commands at a keyboard, and they would cause a cell tower to send out a signal. If you've ever played the game Marco Polo when you were kids in the swimming pool, Marco and then Polo, the response, that's how cell phone tracking works. So the cell phone tower sends out a signal saying, where are you? And your phone responds. And so this is how the location surveillance worked. It worked how it worked in 2003. The police would make the request. An employee of the company would type a few commands at a keyboard. That would cause the signal to get sent out, and then they would locate the phone. And for that act, Nextel charged $150. And if the police wanted to track someone two times, that would cost $300. Every additional request for information led to an additional invoice for $150. Well, as I said before, over the last few years, the number of requests that these companies have received has simply been staggering. They have struggled to keep up with this flood of requests from police and intelligence agencies. And so the telephone companies have done what any technology company would do. They have automated the problem. They have done everything possible to remove the human from the equation. And so Sprint, in particular, set up a self-service website where the police could log in for themselves and get the information when they needed it after they had sent in the right kind of court order. So if the American experience with all-you-can-eat buffets is any demonstration, when you give someone a self-service access to something, they tend to overconsume. And in the first year that this website was set up, it was used 8 million times. Not only was it used a huge number of times, but because the human being had largely been removed from the loop, the amount of money that Sprint could reasonably charge had to go down. So this is a copy of an invoice that Sprint sent to the police that we got through a FOIA request, a Freedom of Information request, last year. You can see at the bottom, it's a little bit fuzzy, I apologize for that, but it says $30. So Sprint moved from a model where they charged $150 every time the police wanted location data to a model of $30 per month for all-you-can-eat access to data about a particular person. Surveillance has gotten cheaper. And in fact, the marginal cost of one more data point is now approaching zero. And so whatever economic disincentive the cost of surveillance once created, that has now been eliminated. And this actually has been captured by Judge Richard Posner, who is one of the most well-respected jurists in the United States. In a case called U.S. v. Garcia in 2007, he wrote that technological progress poses a threat to privacy by enabling an extent of surveillance that in earlier times would have been prohibitively expensive. This uniquely captures this problem. Surveillance has just gotten far too cheap in my country and, as a result, in yours. I actually have evidence for how cheap surveillance has gotten. A few years ago, I got some invoices from many of this inner many of the internet companies send to law enforcement agencies. This is an invoice that Google sent to the U.S. Marshals Service for data associated about a particular person's inbox. Again, I don't know if you can see because of the fuzzy text on the second line, you'll see that there's the number of $25 is there. So this is not a huge fee, and I'm not criticizing Google for charging the government. Actually, I wish surveillance was more expensive, but they're not only able to charge a reasonable fee associated with the actual costs that they bear. Okay, so these companies get requests, and these companies are forced to hand over information. Why do they get so many requests, and why are they giving our information to governments? So this guy is Vince Cerf. He is one of the fathers or grandfathers of the internet. He created a technology, or he's one of the co-creators of a technology called TCP/IP. If you're using any internet-connected device today, you are using something he made constantly. And Vince Cerf is now, I think his title is Internet Architect or Internet Evangelist at Google. He's a very senior position, and he flies around the world saying very thoughtful things. He and I were on a panel a couple years ago, and we talked about why Google didn't encrypt its customers' data, why it didn't use technology to protect its customers' information. And he said, quote, "We couldn't run our system if everything in it were encrypted, because then we wouldn't know which ads to show you. This is a system that was designed around a particular business model." And this was, I think, a very true statement on Vint Cerf's part. There do exist encryption technologies that Google and Microsoft and Facebook and these other tech titans could deploy tomorrow. We're not waiting on the next generation of cryptographic technology that will save us from the government. The technology already exists, but the will isn't there at these companies to deploy it. And the reason the will isn't there is because the business model that has been widely deployed and embraced by Silicon Valley companies is one of free services. We get these products for free. And the way the business model works is we give them our data, and they mine it and manipulate it in return for these fantastic services. We get amazing free email, amazing social network. We get amazing services that allow us to keep in touch with our closest friends and our weakest friends alike. But we don't pay for these services. We pay with our data, and unfortunately, although these companies don't want to enable government surveillance, they are forced to by their business model. There is no way for them to acquire vast amounts of our data that they can use to monetize it without also having that information available for the government when the government wants it. And so really, these privacy model, or these business models are fundamentally incompatible with strong privacy protections from the government. And the reason is because we're not paying for these services. As long as we're getting these services for free, they are always going to have to keep more data than they probably should. And there's nothing they can really do to stop that. They would have to commit essentially corporate suicide and give up their profits if they wish to actually keep our data out of the government's hands. So this isn't the only way. Right? This isn't the only way. People have paid for software and technology in the past, and they are, in fact, paying for software and technology now. We all pay probably too much for our cell phone bills every month. We pay for cable TV. We pay for stamps. We pay for FedEx. We pay for so many of the communication services that we use, yet for some reason our email is free. Our social networking is free. And in fact, there's no way to even pay for it in many cases. There's no way to write Google a check for your Gmail account. There's no way to write Twitter a check or Facebook a check. They will not take our money. But there are other companies that will take our money. And what I want you to think about is whether you really want to continue using these free services and what the cost, what the real cost of these services is. Many of you may have heard of LavaBit, which is a company that made the headlines this summer after it shut down rather than hand over the encryption keys that protected 400,000 of its users. The government was seeking information about one particular user who the government refuses to acknowledge, but we all know is Edward Snowden. And LavaBit shut itself down rather than hand this information over. But LavaBit had a paid service where its ability to operate came from the money that it got from its users. And I think this is the kind of healthy business model we should be encouraging. Another company that has been making headlines is a company called Silent Circle, which is one of the first commercial enterprises offering encrypted telephone service. So you pay them 10, 15 bucks a month, and you can make encrypted telephone calls that cannot easily be wiretapped, or if in fact wiretapped at all. But you have to pay them money, and the recipient of the call also has to pay them money, and they don't get money by monetizing your calls and showing you ads that are related to the hotels that you're staying at. They get money, or they make a profit through the money they charge you. Similarly, Spider Oak, which is a company that offers encrypted backups, it's a direct competitor to Dropbox. They charge for their service, and they don't have any way to access what their users are doing. They don't want to see what their users are doing. And so there are companies that have decided that there's a business model in protecting privacy. But this business model requires that they charge you a fee for the service that they're offering. I really think that we need to think about how we use these services. I think we need to think about whether the business models that we're reliant on are healthy. And ultimately, I think these behavioral advertising supported services are just too expensive. The real price, the price of vast amounts of data sitting there for the government, is in fact far more than we would pay if we were paying in currency. Thank you very much.